The Knowledgeable Provider podcast is intended primarily to entertain, also to inform, but it is not a substitute for actual medical training and should not be used by anyone to diagnose or treat any medical condition in themselves or others. If you need medical advice, please make an appointment to see your own knowledgeable medical provider. The opinions expressed by me and anyone else who happens to appear on the podcast are solely those of the people expressing them and are not necessarily representative of any other entities. Other than the lunches at the office, I do not receive any sort of compensation from pharmaceutical or medical device companies, and I have no other relevant financial disclosures. Look, this is all for fun, okay? Don't sue me. All right, on with the show. Hey there, welcome to Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. This episode is from another episode of the Crossing the Streams Calhoun podcast. I was asked to sit on a panel discussing how the Tuskegee syphilis study relates to vaccine hesitancy. During the pandemic, there was a moment where the Tuskegee syphilis study was being used as justification for people not wanting to get vaccines. And Dr. Gaines, who teaches at Calhoun and is one of the hosts of the Crossing the Streams podcast, was questioning whether or not he should be teaching about the Tuskegee syphilis study for fear that he might be contributing to vaccine hesitancy. The panel is made up of Dr. Gaines, Dr. Thalia Love, myself, and the incomparable Mark Moore, my friend who was on this podcast in the Diabetes Masterclass episode from the first season. It ended up being a good discussion. I think you'll enjoy it. If you want to learn more about the Tuskegee study itself, I recommend American Scandal podcast season 8, where they talk all about that. I learned a lot that I hadn't previously known from listening to that. Just so you know, I'm not in charge of recording or editing the Crossing the Streams podcast audio. I did a little bit to try to clean it up a bit, but I have not taken out or edited any of the content in the episode. So yeah, please enjoy our discussion of the Tuskegee syphilis study and vaccine hesitancy.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Crossing the Streams. I'm Dr. John Gaines.
I'm Thalia Love.
And this week, we have two guests in the house. How about you introduce yourself, Jody?
I'm Jody Marks. I'm a family nurse practitioner here in Decatur and an adjunct faculty member in the nursing department here at Calhoun.
And Mark's on the other side of the table, too.
Sure. I'm Mark Moore. I'm a graphic designer and marketer in the Huntsville area.
You have some special background in relation to what we're talking about, right?
Sure. I used to be the development and marketing director of a nonprofit healthcare facility. But I've always had a love of healthcare. And then, of course, being African American, you know, this is a particularly important topic to talk about.
Mm-hmm. This week, we are going to dig into some rough local history. And I know it's not exactly local, but anything in Alabama to me is local now. We are talking about the Tuskegee syphilis study and the impact on health issues and how that still impacts people today. A big thing with me personally, I have wanted to include this topic in lectures for a very, very long time, but it absolutely scares the heck out of me. I really think the story is absolutely important, but I'm scared that I'll create vaccine skepticism or just distrust for the medical community in general. And historically, we've had some major issues, especially before we got IRBs and you know, informed consent. We're just like, hey, let's grab this person. And that's horrible. And we'll have a little bit in my little spiel here at the end of the story on things that the government and the healthcare industry has put in place at the end. But I so many times, especially in my lectures, people kind of lose the lessons learned sort of things. Like, we're here for the story, and then the outcome, we kind of forget. So kind of running through this, the United States Public Health Service started a syphilis study at Tuskegee, and it started as a six-month descriptive epidemiological study. And it was to look at syphilis in the population of Macon County Alabama, almost at Tennessee. And the study originally enrolled 600 impoverished African-American sharecroppers, men. Of the 300, of the 600, 399 had latent syphilis, and 201 were controls that did not have infections. And they offered free health care for that. Can either of you speak to latent syphilis? As is it active syphilis? Is the other side maybe?
That would be similar to like latent tuberculosis, where the bacteria is in your body, but it's not currently active.
Okay. So we are just hanging out, waiting for it to possibly be active. And that can take a long time. I've heard possibly a month or two to years later.
Correct, right. With syphilis, you kind of get the initial, you know, the canker sore, those initial symptoms. And then if you don't treat it, it progresses to more of a systemic, long-term kind of thing. And yes, the timeline of how long it takes for that to happen is very all over the place, variable.
Is there?
Sure.
Anything that we know why there's a wide timeline on that, or is it just kind of...
There's nothing that I know why.
That happens. all right. So the men that were in the study, this is where it started. This started in 1928, by the way, which is important. The men that were in the study were just treated for bad blood. And that's anything from syphilis, anemia, fatigue, pretty much across the board. I don't know if historically, if we're kind of, I think we're able to more diagnose stuff in the 1920s. My area of specializations in the 1860s with the Civil War, and things were pretty wide open. I've seen death records during the Civil War. One guy said he died presumably of disease, which is, he's not alive anymore. Something happened. So personally, I wrote my dissertation on prostitution during the Civil War, and I had a chapter on sexually transmitted infections. And what's really scary is that's 1860, 1865, and we're in 1928, and not a lot has changed. We are still using some mercurial salves, which is not good for you. We're also using something which, in the Civil War, we weren't using this, but an arsenic-based medication. From what I read, it said that was mildly effective. Are we still using arsenic-based, I imagine, for something?
I'm going to say no.
Okay, good. yeah, it said it was mildly effective. From my stuff, we in 1860s, people prescribe something and you feel better when you stop taking it. And so that might be the mildly effective.
Plus, when you think about you know, STDs, if they have a presenting and then it goes away, people think, oh, I'm fine. Then you have the latency and it's now wreaking havoc in your body.
Yeah. And I don't think we're doing this now in 1928, but treatment during the Civil War, if you find the canker, they'll just cauterize that and hey, you're cured. You know, so
now it's a good old shot, thank goodness.
Which much better. Treatment for gonorrhea at the time is a urethral injection of silver nitrate.
Oof.
Ouch. Yeah. I've read about people getting that treatment and dying. I'm guessing they perforated the
bladder,
that yep. thing.
Yeah, I would guess so.
Medical terminology. when this started, like I said, we start this in 1928, antibiotics, the big effective treatment for syphilis isn't going to be available widely for another 15 years. It's after the World War II is where you really see antibiotics becoming publicly available. But even when antibiotics are available in 46, 47, these guys aren't told. They are really clearly try to hide any kind of treatment. Instead, they continue the study on the participants. They even withhold information about penicillin. A lot of the guys, 256 of the subjects registered for the draft and were diagnosed with syphilis during intake and were set to be treated, but people that were operating with the public health service prevented them from getting treatment and got them out of the draft so that they can continue the study. It gets worse. One of the researchers, quote, said, "This study is of great importance from a scientific standpoint. It represents one of the last opportunities which the science of medicine will have to conduct an investigation of this kind." That's a part where I want to pause, because I've heard on other podcasts and other accounts on this that really there's no reason to continue this study. They're not learning anything valuable at this point, and I haven't seen this anywhere else, but I imagine you could do this with lab animals. I mean, that's not great, but, you know, not humans is better.
Probably have to go back in time and recognize that there was a the thinking of us being different and yes, and more expendable, and that wasn't just the men in the Tuskegee test. It was also, you know, how they treated Black women as well in different medical experimentation. So
right, and even on your comment on being different, it's either during World War II or right after the medical community starts being okay with mixing the blood supply, that they were purposely keeping African-American blood for African-Americans and transfusions and white blood for white folks. Right after World War II, I think?
I'm not the historian, but yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know
either. Like, John, you didn't know this stuff.
Yes, but again, nothing would surprise me, Zach.
I know. I wouldn't be surprised if you told me it was last year that they quit doing that. I mean,
yes. Yeah, I was lecturing about Brown versus Board the other day, and in Brown 2, there's a negotiation for when should we desegregate the schools, and the opponents for Brown said 2020.
Wow.
So yeah, that's humans are horrible. It get worse. 1947, penicillin becomes the standard therapy for syphilis, and the United States government starts health programs for rapid treatment system centers, where they send groups of people out into the rural communities to try to treat syphilis. One of these even locates in Macon County, where the Tuskegee study is going on, and the researchers actively prevent the study subjects from getting care. Some of them apparently did, not through those studies, but I guess they went outside of the study and didn't tell anybody. They didn't get enough of a dose of penicillin to actually cure them, so they still had to contend with that. Almost done. 1972, 74 of the subjects are still alive. Out of the total 399 with latent syphilis, 28 had died of syphilis, 100 had died of related complications, 40 people infected their wives, 19 children were born with congenital syphilis. And finally, this is where it starts turning around in 1972, a whistleblower, a guy that was doing, it was an STI investigator out in San Francisco named Peter Buxton, started telling the press. And what makes that really, really rough is that for the last 50 years, this information was coming out to the medical community in studies. And so it wasn't really a hidden thing. The medical communities, if you were subscribing to journals, you could easily read about this, and no one is yelling and screaming about this. And it's not until 72 where Peter Buxton. I don't know if he's a doctor or what.
I don't think so. I think he was a journalist based on what I've read about this, I think.
Okay. What is cool, after he voices that and gets the attention of the larger press and getting this out there, the United States government, out of the Department of Health and Human Services, starts the Office of Human Research Protections that oversees clinical trials. They institute institutional review boards, where if you are using human subjects in any kind of study, university or otherwise, an outside group, maybe that's made up of people within the university as well as some outsiders. I'm a historian, didn't have to do this, but they review your study to make sure you're not actually causing harm. And my wife's a psychologist, and you know, for her dissertation and her master, she had to get IRB approval. It's a pretty serious project to get that pushed through. And finally, in 1997, Bill Clinton formally apologized at a ceremony held at the White House. I believe that four of the surviving members of the Tuskegee study showed up. And last thing that I want to say on kind of this big spiel is, in class, I kind of mentioned those things a lot where, you know, sort of the government, the state government, the federal government, whatever, will make an apology after some of these things like this. And in most of the situations, all of the people have long passed away. I think in 1988, the Massachusetts governor apologized for Salem, you know. And I used to, when I was younger, think that that was just like, well, that's just kind of dumb. It doesn't affect anybody. And it doesn't, you know, when I was younger, I thought it didn't mean anything. But now I feel like it is important that we do at least make those acknowledgments that, hey, we as a community, we as a society, we as a government have made missteps. And we should, you know, recognize those and hopefully maybe slightly prevent them from happening again. And now I've talked for 15 minutes and I'm sorry. But my big thing is, again, I'm scared of teaching this. And my thing is that I'm going to call somebody to say, I don't want any treatments. You've heard of Tuskegee because, you know, John was babbling about this in class. And how would you guys respond to that?
Well, you know, I will say that some people already will use that as an excuse. Mm-hmm. And we saw that during the COVID pandemic when the vaccine became available. So there's going to be that hesitancy in some communities anyway. Mm-hmm. But education is always, you know, the road to power. So the more that we can educate people about what happened at Tuskegee, just so they know, and so they don't conflate what happened there with vaccines, because it's a different situation. You know, Tuskegee was about people, the medical community and the government preying on a vulnerable population. Mm-hmm. Whereas with something like vaccines that are for all the population, that just becomes a public health issue. And so we have to use that education to make sure that people don't mistake the two. So I would definitely lean toward you teaching it and also allowing that as an opportunity to expand the conversation more. You mentioned about the Salem witch trials and politicians making apologies for deeds that are long past, but you know, we do need more of that. We need mm-hmm. to recognize that our country has a deep history of atrocity alongside of our accomplishments. And the only way we can really move forward in a healthy way and is by being informed on both things. And we also have to recognize that some of the past atrocities of previous administrations, problems performed by federal agencies to the highest level, do have lasting repercussions, whether that's redlining or, you know, housing loans, you know, healthcare disparity. There's just all sorts of different ways that our past has handicapped different people in the community. Mm-hmm. And the more we know about that, the more that people now take take ownership of what happened in the past. That's the way we can move forward to fix things and have retribution and stuff like that.
What do you think, Jody?
Well, I agree. I mean, I would say, if you're asking for my advice about teaching it, I would err on the side of teaching it.
Okay.
And I don't know, but I can't imagine that, I guess your students are at the youngest are 18, 19.
Yeah.
Surely they already know about it in some degree.
I don't know.
I wonder because, you know, I don't feel like there's anything I learned in school.
No.
And I feel like a lot of school has only gotten worse. So as far as, you know, teaching certain elements of history, especially in the element of history that makes the country look bad. And that's what this would be.
Sure. Well, in that case, it's even more important to teach it. And I would also imagine that I would also imagine that somebody who's already had 18, 19 years of experience with institutional racism and mm-hmm. all that, this wouldn't be a surprise, even if they'd never heard of it specifically.
Yeah. I don't think, especially in my class, this starting in 1928, you know that some stuff's happened. Like I've gone through some really heavy institutional racism and all kinds of stuff like that. But yeah, it's just the vaccine hesitancy and just, you know, that's the part that I'm scared of.
Yeah, I was generally surprised when I started hearing people using that as an excuse for the vaccine because, okay, so I'm 52. And these were people that were younger than me mm-hmm. using Tuskegee as an excuse to not take the vaccine. And I thought, this shouldn't even be top of mind for you. This is something, you know, that people older than me, that's, you know, would have on their mind, my grandparents type of age. So what this to me is, it's like a generational kind of warning that maybe has come down. And then I wonder how far outside of Alabama does that even stretch? Is this just something that's talked about in rural Alabama families? You know who? And so when I saw that, I thought, "Are you just looking for an excuse? What is there, or what's feeding this fear?" Because again, it wasn't apples and oranges, or it's apples and oranges. And when I think about the COVID 19 vaccine and the hesitancy that came about because of people using Tuskegee as an example, I just thought that's just not mathing for me. You know, I think you can be fully aware of what happened and how awful it was and see that it's different from this vaccine that is for the entire country.
That's the thing that I'm like with Tuskegee, we're definitely picking on a very small population and an African-American population because there's a high dose of racism in this one. And with the COVID vaccine, it's everybody come and get this. And, you know, maybe. And I'm horrible in my head, so forgive me. But the only thing that I could maybe go with what you're saying is the rollout where we were giving it to elderly people first, mm-hmm. and maybe we're trying to wipe out the old people.
Well, you know,
that would have just been like, hey, nobody else take that.
Well, there definitely were conspiracy theories about it because, again, I was working at a healthcare facility at the time, mm-hmm. and so I was seeing a lot of the mix of people who were eager to get it versus those that were hesitant. And it crossed racial, socioeconomic boundaries. There was no common line of who felt one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So looking at it from the outside was super interesting, but I really, I just saw it as what it was. We're giving it to the people who are most vulnerable first. Mm-hmm. And because we were actually seeing people dying.
Yeah.
You know, we had spent, you know, and because it so drastically affected our lifestyles, you know, I was working from home. We were working from home and we were the first few months we were, you know, washing our groceries, the you know, wiping off the cans, yep, you know, spraying our shoes when we came in, you know, all of the drastic things that happened beyond masking. Mm-hmm. And before that, in my ignorance and naivete, when I would see people in other countries wearing masks in public transport and out on the street, I would look at them like, what are you doing? What's going on? Yeah. Because I'd come from a very American, you know, kind of mindset. And then once it happened to us and we were having to mask to not only protect ourselves, but to protect the people around us and to protect the people in our lives who were more vulnerable, be they older or immunocompromised, I thought, well, this is just the bare minimum that we should do. And then when it comes to vaccines, I look at it the same way. It's the bare minimum of what we can do to protect the community. And being gay, recognizing that there have been times that the government, the medical establishment, has treated my community different in that regard too.
Absolutely.
You know, it's kind of like, okay, so, you know, take HIV, for example. I was a teenager when HIV came out. And the slow rollout for care and the slow search for a cure, because it really was just killing my people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until it became a danger to heterosexuals that we, and also the advocacy of groups like ACT UP saying, find a cure, find some treatment. Those two things, making the medical establishment actually put some work into it. I see the same thing as when you're looking at the vulnerable, you know, during COVID. It's kind of like, if this is something you see that's affecting everybody, at least use that as a marker that it can be trusted.
You're kind of quiet over there. She's been shaking her head a whole lot. She's like, my gosh, what the?
Well, just a couple of things. I think that younger students really do not have any knowledge of a whole lot of things. Anything that was before them, they just don't know it exists. And if it's not taught in school, they have no way of knowing. But they knew about the Tuskegee study because parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles were feeding them that information. Because when we talked about it in my classes, don't you know about Tuskegee? And so I think that there is a lot of that. And it is not restricted to Alabama. And some of it has to do with the entire scope of the medical disparities. And so I think it was a combination of that and the reports that this vaccine came out too quickly. And so it's a lack of knowledge about the medical community and research and what all had gone into that. And a lot of times people just don't have information. I happen to have a brother who was a research chemist and had been working. He's a pharmaceutical research chemist. And so the first thing he said is, oh yeah, I've had a contract with Pfizer for 30 years. So this isn't new.
Yeah, right.
And so that combination with, we don't know it's new, we don't know anything about it. And so maybe there's something they're not telling us, and it's going to be just like Tuskegee. But how they missed that whole, no, they kept the medicine from you in Tuskegee. That's a whole different ballgame. But yeah. I think also a lot of vaccine anti-vaxxers that came out because it supposedly causes autism and all of those kinds of things. So I think it was that combination, and people go get a flu shot and don't realize that's a vaccine.
Yeah,
sure. Or I had a friend that refused to get a flu shot because of fears that they would be the one that would have some sort of adverse reaction until COVID came out. And again, we started knowing people who got really sick and or died, and her mentality changed. And she was like, now she gets the flu and the COVID vaccine regularly. You also mentioned something about kind of what people don't know and generational. It makes me think, too, of when I was young, my grandfather and mother were distrustful of me going to play at my white friend's house because their experience growing up was different than mine. And when you have that generational distrust, that's what sometimes gets held onto. So if like I said, aunties and grandparents had distrust about Tuskegee, that's something that's easy to pass along. Mm-hmm. And like all things, you know, learning something wrong the first time is harder than learning it right. It takes two or three times to get it right after that. So
I agree, because recently in class, we were talking about what are some cultural differences, and several of the African-American kids were saying, oh, no, you don't spend the night at somebody's house. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was looking at me and they thought, well, did you spend the night at folks' house? I said, you don't know. My parents didn't allow us to do that. And I remember I had, you know, friends of mine, because my children, their friends are multicultural. And I can remember my daughter had a birthday party, mm-hmm. and it was about half and half. And some of the kids whose parents, some of the African-American parents, you know, were, oh, you invited them and they came? Mm-hmm. And so I think there hasn't been a lot of intermingling outside, even after integration. You had that mingling in the classroom, but socially, a lot of times it doesn't exist.
Yeah. You know, something else that's interesting that I've been enjoying learning about is the connection between African Americans and rural white people.
Yes.
And how much of our cultures are parallel and similar, and shouldn't have the division that some want to put between them. And that also comes to vaccine hesitancy. One of my friends that, you know, he gave me all the reasons. It came out too fast. It's too new, this, that, and the other. And I'm like, where's all this distrust coming from? Even your conservative parents have gotten the vaccine and want you to get it. Why are you being the ignorant one in the bunch? and it's unfortunate, because, you know, it's some of those same kind of ways that we approach the world comes into that, and I think defeating that distrust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, like you said, I think it's true. Well, I think it's true in all rural areas, not just Alabama. And I'm not sure. I know I knew, but my father was at Tuskegee from like 46 to 50. So.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yes, my father went to Tuskegee. And so, of course, I knew about it mm-hmm. pretty early on.
Okay.
And I just assumed everybody did.
He was there when the study was going on?
Yeah, he was there from 1946 to 1950.
As a student?
As a student.
Okay. Was everybody there aware of it? Like, did he know it was going on at the time it was going on?
He didn't know it was going on at the time. He was also right out of the military. He was right out of the Army.
Okay.
So, well, to my knowledge, he was not aware of it. But my father's generation would not have told me.
Okay.
But he did tell us after the study when that came out, because I was a teenager at the time.
Wow. Okay.
There was a lot of talk about it.
Sure.
In our house.
Okay. You know, you also mentioned about the timing of you know, your, I think it was your cousin, nephew that had worked on it.
My brother.
Your brother. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the other thing I think that people don't recognize, when a solution, a cure, a treatment is discovered in what we consider fast, you know, people have been working on the next step. And it oftentimes takes a catastrophe to move it along. You know, some of the greatest advancements happen during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think for this current generation, COVID-19 was warlike in
sure.
that, by the impact that it had on us collectively. And so it made perfect sense for me that we would have a fast solution. I was, again, at home going, hurry up.
Yeah, should, you know, I was too.
Get on it. And then also knowing, you know, once mRNA came out and they were like, this is it, this is where we're moving. And once they said there's opportunity for other things, I instantly went to, we're going to get a cure for HIV out of this. We're going to get a cure for cancer out of this. You know, this is going to be groundbreaking, just like in previous years. And that goes back into what we talked about earlier, the not having the right focus in education. So if you're teaching kids, even in bad situations like war, you have these advancements.
Mm-hmm.
you know, then they can be primed to recognize that in the face of adversity, you know, we can find greatness as a country.
Sure, that's a great point. Yeah, almost everything we know about trauma care in medicine came from battlefield medicine.
Yeah, that's rough.
And I was going to say too, I had the same question you did about why would you associate the Tuskegee study with vaccine hesitancy? I found an article on NPR from 2021 where they talked about that specifically. And one of the points was there was a misconception about the Tuskegee study that people were given syphilis, were injected with syphilis. And so maybe they were hypothesizing that might have been part of why somebody would make that connection. I'll send that to you if you want to link it in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think that also talks about the lawsuit, right? I think it was a $10 million
set. Correct. Thing? Yeah. One of the
survivors got a $10 million payout. Some of the survivors, I think, however, were left, which, you know, we need more of that. If the system does you wrong, you need to be paid back. And sometimes all you can be paid back is in money.
Sure.
Yeah. The thing that I would really like to see on top of that, you know, reparations. Kind of a thing, I really think that the individuals involved need to chip in on that. Because I think that too often, you know, an organization will make a misstep and all the people that are within the organization have no stake in the game. And if they're kind of made to chip in on that, not all of it, but a decent amount, enough so that it hurts so that you change the actions within that organization. Mm-hmm. I think we do need to move in that direction. So,
but I'm not sure. Well, they give them some leeway because they're doing a study under the auspices of whatever the organization is. And mm-hmm. so with Henrietta Lacks, mm-hmm. they didn't give that family any money. Mm-hmm. The author of the book initiated the having them to receive money. So, and even after she had published her book, one of Henrietta Lacks' sons was waiting until he turned 65 and got Medicare to get treatment.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Well, I think that they've gotten some money, right? At this point?
I think the grandchildren.
Okay. Yeah. I think I saw something about that recently, but that's, man, that's still, that was like a year ago, maybe.
Yes, it was very
recent.
Very
recent. Mm-hmm.
It was very recent.
Yeah. And I don't think it was a ton of money, if I remember right, just from what I've read. It wasn't like, yeah, they're not like wildly rich because of this now. Yeah.
Right, because Johns Hopkins, you know, it was under the auspices of they were doing a study. And so nobody was held responsible for the unethical behavior. Mm-hmm. And sure. I think that's it.
And that ties into just how a lot of our systems work. So we're talking about important things like healthcare, but look at TLC. They were producing all those songs, they were doing all those concerts, but their contract was done in such a way that only the people at the top profited, and they didn't. So this comes down to John Hopkins being at the top and profiting, the country profiting. You know, it's a power thing. And that's what we got people to realize is that someone will always be willing to take advantage of you. And we have to work on making sure the systems protect everyone, no matter what it is.
True. Yeah. And I think, too, like I said, the overall health care disparities. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure what the health care disparity was when I was growing up, but I do know I had to go in a separate waiting room with mm-hmm. wooden chairs.
Wow.
As opposed to the leather chairs on the other side.
The big thing that I've heard more recently is that African Americans get sort of dismissed on pain level.
Yes.
And then Caucasian people, I don't know about maybe Hispanic people and Asian people are lumped in the Caucasian side, maybe on the pain
level. Well, with Hispanic, it's how they present.
Yeah.
It's how people will treat you. Because at the end of the day, people are treating you how you look. So if you're, you know, Black Hispanic, they're going to treat you like you're Black.
That's true.
And Asian people are usually treated along the lines of white people. Like you have the Asian minority, model minority kind of treatment that they get. But yeah, it's particularly Black women and the pain levels. You know, and that was something I had to learn about too as an adult, you know, just kind of seeing the disparity that my sisters were feeling and dealing with, and being fortunate in that my male privilege kind of protected me from that. Because I was, you know, I was able to advocate for myself in a different way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my daughter complains about that. She broke her ankle about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, went to the little urgent care at first. And they sent her home. Mm. She kept saying, it's broken. I heard it pop. Mm-hmm. And so then when she goes in to the orthopedic doctor, you know, a few days later, they're like, you're actually walking on this?
Yeah.
You shouldn't be able to walk. But
and one way I think that some people better navigate the system is finding healthcare providers who are part of their community.
Yeah.
So, you know, women go to women gynecologists, Black people go to Black healthcare providers, gay people go to LGBTQ providers. We seek that out so that we can be protected within that space.
Sure, absolutely.
There was something I was going to say and it just like fell out. Kind of on the pain level thing and your daughter's ankle, 5 years ago, maybe, I think I'd been here for maybe about a year. We were moving house and I popped my ACL. I was moving a file cabinet and I'm dumb and it was very heavy and it just kind of went with me and I popped my ACL. And it weirdly didn't hurt. Like, I am not a tough man at all. Like, small things harm me. And I don't like that. But for some reason, my brain was just like, I don't think you can handle that level of what's going on there. And so my brain just turned it off. And I went to an orthopedist, and he was, like, shocked about, like, why isn't this hurting you? Like, I had to, like, I don't need any pain medication, please. I'm good. Not a tough dude, but no. So, yeah, there's that weird kind of me having to push a little bit on the opposite side of I don't need pain medication where, you know, an African-American person would be like, no, this is actually hurting.
And then they start looking at you like, are you hunting for drugs?
That's what they do.
Medication. In fact, when I used to take my mother to the ER when she was having problems, and she would be, and the thing is, if you go to the ER on any sort of regular basis, you know what works for you. Mm-hmm. So you might be dealing with a provider that doesn't know anything about you. They're looking at what's going on right now. They have looked at your previous charts. So she would go in and say, that doesn't work for me. I need this. Yeah. And I had to go stop it. You need to go through the process, because if you go in asking for this specific pain medicine, they're not going to give it to you because they're going to assume you're looking for drugs.
Right.
And I don't think that white people have to worry about that.
I've never experienced that and never seen it.
Yeah.
From you know, white perspective on the side.
No, that's a frequent occurrence when people go to the emergency room. That and if you're elderly, mm-hmm. you know. Well, what do you expect? You're 80 years old.
Yeah.
Like they don't know pain that they should, what acceptable pain, you know?
Yeah.
Hmm. And you also have to wonder, like, how, you know, we have been conditioned to expect certain levels of pain as acceptable.
Yeah.
Or even looking at not going to the doctor at all. I was watching a medical show the other day, and the person was like hesitant to go to the doctor because he said, if I go for this, I'm going to come out with this that much bigger. They're going to find something wrong that's, you know, so people have a lot of fear about that. And I go from the same point, let me go so you can fix it, whatever it is, while it's small.
Mm-hmm.
So that it can be easier on me and easier on my wallet. And that's something we just, as a society, we need to get people more into the thinking of. But, you know, again, when you come to the disparity of health, like in all things, you know, being poor is expensive. And if you don't have insurance through your job or whatever the case may be, you are going to put the doctor off because you really have to be more concerned with rent and food. And by the time that that the health problem says you have to pay attention to me, then it's going to be that much more expensive and that much more time consuming.
And because they don't have insurance to cover things, they go to the ER because they'll take them. And so they end up going to the ER for everything.
Everything.
And also putting things off until it necessitates a trip to the ER.
You absolutely have to go.
But you're right. That's socioeconomic as well.
Yeah, sure.
You've done rotations in the ER?
I was a paramedic for a long time. Okay. And then, yes, I've done training in the ER. I've never worked in the ER specifically. I agree. Half of my brain wants to speak up for the medical community and go, no, that doesn't happen at all. But it totally does. I mean, it's 100%. I'd like to think there is more thought that goes into things other than just, oh, this is a black person, so I'm not going to give him pain medicine. But there is definitely that racial bias in the individual providers. I mean, 100%. There are other things that go into it, like, are they really a drug addict, or with older people, is it more dangerous to give them the medicine than it is to not? I would not disagree with anything anybody has said about bias. That definitely happens, and I hate to see that. And yes, the environment in the ER is horrible for like listening to people and taking people at their word. I think they get sort of jaded, I guess is a good word. It's a battlefield. I mean, it's a war zone in there all the time.
Yeah.
And you do see examples of where people come in and legitimately have a problem and are trying to get somebody to listen to them, and they just get blown off because people just make assumptions about them and shove them over in the corner, and that's it. And it's a rough environment. It's a rough place to try to go to get healthcare if you're not actively dying.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's socioeconomic. A lot of that is socioeconomic. Like you said, those differences from rural whites and blacks, it's very similar.
Sure. And you'll see that, people of color who arrive, who rise to a certain level of socioeconomic status will then be kind of smacked in the head when the race still trumps how they're treated in a given situation. And I don't think there can be anything more frustrating than that, because we're taught the American way of what's going to come to success. And then you achieve a level of success and you're like, the system is still skewed against me. And despite all the criticisms that I've laid out, that we've laid out against the system, I still firmly believe in using the system. So I'm a proponent of healthcare and preventative care. But I just say it, you've got to be an advocate for yourself. You've got to be knowledgeable. You've got to listen. You've got to, pay attention. I'm just really an advocate for healthcare.
And we should tweak the system, though. I'm with you on that, kind of from my experience. The system seems to sort of work, but it does. Everything needs improvement. And then that's one of the big things in my class is, things are okay for a group, but if you add more people to the group, everybody to the group, and kind of improve things across the board, everything works better,
Yeah, and some of that is education, like you said, what's being taught in terms of, preventive care. That wasn't a thing, years ago. And so that's one of those changes that has come out of some of these atrocities that have happened, is more of the teaching people how to take care of themselves. Every doctor's office, you see the pamphlets, you see the information, trying to get information to people. But I think a lot of times people go to a doctor, he's supposed to be the expert, and they don't understand the value of them paying attention to their own bodies and that advocating for themselves. We leave people in the hospital and we come see them a couple of times a day, and we're not paying attention to what's going on with them. And I think we have to teach more about being an advocate and not trusting someone with your care, because they're doing a process of elimination. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't tell me, I don't know. And so I think that we just need to do more of that and to be aware of what's going on with you.
You have to have an advocate, especially in the hospital. If you can't speak up for yourself or don't have somebody that will speak up for you, things are going to fall through the cracks. I mean, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Yeah.
You know, so it's super important to have an advocate. And even in, like you were saying, even in my practice, people will say to me all the time, well, you know, you're the doctor. I'm not the expert here. And I'll say, well, you're the expert on your body and your situation. Like, this is not a paternalistic, I'm telling you what to do. This is a negotiate. This is a discussion. This mm-hmm. is a negotiation. Like, what's going to work for you in this situation? But yeah, super, super important point. People definitely have to speak up for themselves.
Yeah. And like I was talking about earlier with my knee, everybody works differently. Like after I popped my ACL, I'm weird. And I just like watched all kinds of YouTube videos of people doing that. And, you know, everybody's knee kind of kicks out to the side. And probably just because it's on YouTube, we're only watching the people that are screaming afterwards. And I was like, wow, that does look unpainful, you know? And yeah, we're just a weird sort of organism where for some reason something doesn't hurt on me. And for someone, you know, else, it could be absolutely painful. And, you know,
sure. Sure. Also, and, you know, it's interesting too to think about, we think about a lot of things in a baseline mm-hmm. and what the expectation is. And especially in diagnoses, you know, medical people learn what they learn in school from a textbook. All of those things oftentimes are using white men as the baseline.
Right.
And so then you have to start. I'm so excited that we have medical professionals now that are saying, hey, this presents differently in Black people on dark skin. You know, if you're looking for this rash, for this, you know, ailment, it looks like this on a white person. Guess what? It looks like this on a Black person. And, you know, you don't think about those things. But those things are so important because, again, that's an early diagnostic tool that you have to be aware, which is, again, why, you know, when I, as an adult, look for a doctor, I look for an LGBT doctor because I want them to pay attention to things that will affect me specifically as a gay man. Mm-hmm. And then I'll educate them on being Black if they don't happen to be Black. So
that's very cool. All right. Do we have anything else that sort of closing thoughts or a different direction we want to go in?
You know, get your education, man. Learn not to be afraid of science and medicine,
yeah,
and recognize that it's going to change. That's the big thing. I think a lot of people said, well, they told me this week one, and now week 10, they're saying something completely different. I said, yeah, because we have new information.
That was a big thing. That was something interesting as a historian, like to watch during the COVID pandemic was, you know, we have this limited amount of information, so go wipe down your groceries, mm-hmm. go, you know, spray off your shoes and stuff like that. And then, you know, as we learn more and more about how this transmits and things like that, then, oh, well, you know, now you're just changing the game. No, we figured out this is the method of transmission.
Right.
So
that was a huge source of frustration for patients during all that. Unfortunately, it all got misconstrued. We know it all got misconstrued and politicized, and it was a disaster. Right.
But it really was exhausting because I'm here trying to get back to a semblance of normalcy, while telling people at the same time we're never going back to what it was.
Yeah,
you know, the world is completely different now, and I expect to get a COVID booster every year, like I get my flu shot, and I'm okay with that because I have friends who lost spouses and children and parents, you know, from a virus that was indiscriminate. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And yeah, just continue to be open-minded and, you know, not let fear control you.
That works. All right. Well, thank you guys so, so much. I will definitely write up a lecture and throw this into the mix now.
Oh, do it. One thing I was gonna throw in is, are you familiar with the story about Cotton Mather and Onesimus? Mm-hmm. You're familiar? So this there was a Cotton Mather. This guy had an enslaved person who he named Onesimus. We don't know his birth name, but Onesimus had come from Africa, where they were already doing the technique of putting smallpox, infected serum from smallpox people into non-infected people as a form of vaccination. And so there was this outbreak of smallpox in Boston, and that knowledge, made its way into the white community, and it turned out to be a good thing. So if you wanted to throw something in to kind of counterbalance,
that'd be brilliant.
Something like that would be a great, great story to balance it out with, where here's an instance where the African community came up with this technique that ended up being a great thing. So maybe that would be a good counterpoint.
I would have loved to have learned that in school.
Sure. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Also, Peter Buxton, I looked up, was a social worker and an epidemiologist in San Francisco. He was not a journalist, but he worked for the Public Health Service, and he heard about the Tuskegee study just from coworkers. So that's how that came about. Okay. And arsenic, it's still around for some animal things that are used in animal studies, but the FDA pulled a bunch of the approval for it a few years ago. So I think there's, as far as I can tell, there's only one thing left. It's arsenic base that's used in research, but not given to people.
Okay. And we do give stuff that's rough. Like, chemotherapy.
For sure. Yeah,
we're almost going to kill you, but we're going to kill the cancer first, and then we'll stop.
Yeah, 100%. Which the new biological agents are way better than the old stuff, but.
Yeah. I'm really hoping for that mRNA vaccine for different forms of cancer. That would be some. I'll take a week of a sniffles or a couple of days of sniffles, even for some kind of vaccine on that front. So, all right. Well, thank you guys so very, very much for joining us. And thank you for being co-host today, Thaley.
You're welcome.
All right. Until next time, we will talk at you later.
All right, that does it for this episode of Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to like, subscribe, or follow on your preferred listening platform. Give us a nice 5-star rating and leave a nice review. If you'd like to help support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/knowledgeableprovider. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients, in that order. The book.